Well, hi, Randy. What's going on?
How you doing, Jim?
So what are we talking about today?
Well, this time we're going to talk about the physics of time travel.
The physics of time travel.
That's right. You know, there's a lot of ways to look at this subject, and I was thinking that maybe the right way to go about this is to start with the really well-established things that we have proven and know, and then work our way into increasingly theoretical areas so that we can get into the really bizarre stuff after we've covered what we already know.
Okay, so, you know, now I'm really confused. What do you mean, what do we really know, Randy?
Time is malleable. We've learned that. We've experimentally detected those effects. The GPS satellite system is like a 24/7 experiment that constantly proves the validity of special relativity and general relativity. And both of those entail these time dilation effects that show us that time isn't the constant factor that Newton thought that it was.
Okay, so you'd just like to start off with relativity in some way?
Yeah, let's start with the stuff that we know for a fact. Like, they've done experiments where you put an atomic clock on a jet plane, and then you fly it at a high velocity and then bring it back, and you can see that it's not at the same time as the clock that was left at the airport where you took off from. That's kind of weird, but it's cool.
Well, yeah. Now, that particular experiment, as I recall, which I wasn't prepared to talk about, but that particular experiment is one of the classic tests of general relativity, right?
Well, it's both. I think that they were looking to prove that a high speed actually changes the rate of time when you're moving, but then you kind of can't help but also account for the fact that the airplane goes up in the air, and so it's at a lower gravitational potential than the clocks on the ground, so you sort of have to calculate both in order to figure out the end results, but they match perfectly.
Okay, so really what we're thinking about here is sort of the dynamical effects of time.
Yeah, that's right.
That when two people are moving relative to one another, for example, in special relativity, they're going to measure the amount of time it takes some third thing to happen differently. I think that that's the important thing there.
The relativity of simultaneity.
Oh, and there's that whole relativity of simultaneity thing, which is extremely important. So yeah, and that's a little more interesting. That'll get us into the whole idea about time-like and space-like. When you're talking about relativity of simultaneity, you're in a little bit of a problem there because, you know, you just have to define simultaneity. And if you have, you know, what I think is our native idea about time, that one instant follows another instant and so forth and so on, and we just keep accumulating instants, right? And keep adding more and more and more history. And everybody's doing that all at the same time, and everybody's doing that all at the same rate. Then you can talk about sort of simultaneity. When I pick up my fork, my wife puts down her glass or something like that. So that's what we'd normally think of. But when you get into general relativity, it turns out that what you would think of as that same time doesn't work out anymore. And there are a couple of reasons for that. It's just a good idea to say, okay, well, what do we mean by everything happening at the same time? And we just say everything happens at the same time coordinate or something like that. But that doesn't make a lot of sense after you start adding in these time dilation and Lorentz contraction effects in special relativity, where things get smaller and move slower, I think.
Yeah, durations change. You know, on board, if you're moving in a craft that's moving close to the speed of light and you observe something ahead of you, you know, its duration can appear to be shorter on your reference frame than it is back on Earth where you left from. So suddenly these ideas about time and duration, there's even the, you know, the relativity of simultaneity with respect to position, because at great distances, you know, if you're close to an event that happens, it appears to happen sooner than it would somebody that's farther away. With Einstein's theories, we suddenly have these experimentally proven factors that change the rate of time and the nature of simultaneity and all this stuff. So it opens up some really intriguing possibilities that we're going to talk about.
And so you end up with this situation where you can't really even call two things simultaneous, right? I mean, we talk about the relativity of simultaneity, but you can't really call them simultaneous. You can really only ask yourself, can something that happens this time at this place affect something that happens at this later time in some other place? And if the answer is yes, then you're dealing with what you call a time-like distance between them. And if the answer is no, then you have a space-like distance between them. And if you're right on that cusp, then you're a photon, and that's something else.
Yep, that's true. I was thinking about the clock synchronization procedure and things like that that Einstein brought into it to try to give us a handle on this.
Well, in general, I found the clock thing more confusing than helpful, but maybe you don't. Usually, I just wonder who set up all these clocks. And why are a bunch of them moving at one speed in one direction and the other ones all sitting still?
Actually, what you brought up is a really important point, is that although we can have debates about the relativity of simultaneity, one of the things that seems sacrosanct in physics is causality. And that's one of the things that was preserved in special relativity, is that regardless of your state of motion or where you are, that all observers agree about causality. One thing happens before the other. And so we're going to, later on in the program, we're going to talk about how that might break down even.
Yeah, that's actually another topic entirely, but it's a useful one to get into a little bit here. But yeah, I mean, if there's going to be time travel, then at some level, you're going to have a problem with causality. It may be only at the macro scale, but it's still something that's going to look a little bit funny when you start talking about causes and effects, if you can make a loop in time. And that's where a lot of these problems show up, all of these paradoxes that people like to talk about.
Right. That's why I wanted to start with the simple stuff like special relativity and gravitational time dilation.
Let's start with the simple stuff like general relativity, and then we'll get to something more complicated.
Well, what I mean by simple is that we have a good mathematical grasp on this stuff, and we've observed it, and we know that it's real. So when you've got a situation like if there's somebody in space when they're watching their clock move and they're looking at you on the surface of the Earth deeper in a gravitational potential, they can say that your clock is moving more slowly. That doesn't just show that time moves at a different rate from one reference frame to the other. But I think you can also look at that as time travel, because to the observer in space looking down on the Earth, they're moving into the future faster than you are on the Earth. So in a sense, with every passing moment, you're kind of moving further into their past, because their clock is getting further and further behind yours. So in a sense, that's a crude kind of time travel.
Yeah, that's sort of the reason why I wanted to ask you what time travel was when we started, is because there are a lot of different ways you can talk about it. Yeah, I've seen at least one video or television program or something where somebody started just with that. We're all traveling in time right now. You know, everybody's advancing in time, you're stuck with it. But that sounded a little boring if you're going to use that as a definition of time travel. So you'd really like to have some sort of definition that would get rid of things that are fairly mundane. And I think in this sense, something that's mundane would include something like a flat space-time, anything that would be a Minkowski space, anything in special relativity. That's really mundane as far as time travel is concerned.
Well, although there is the twin paradox.
Yeah, but the twin paradox is showing you something about the world that's very important, that's related to that definition between a time-like area and a space-like area that we were talking about before, which is that the longest time between any two events in space-time is going to be in the reference frame where those two events are at the same spatial location.
They're motionless, right? Like they're not moving relative to one another.
Well, I mean, you're in a reference frame where if you're not adding any forces, right, if you're not accelerating at all, you're going to start at one point and end up at the other point. So in that reference frame, which is the reason why I've called them events, in that reference frame, you are going to be at one point in space. Although for some other person who's moving at a different speed, they're going to look like they're different points in space, which is the whole idea about relativity of space and time. So with the twin paradox, the idea is that there's one twin who stays on Earth, and there's another one that zips off to a nearby star to pick up some Cheetos and zips back.
It's a long trip.
Well, you know, when it's 12:30 and you've got the munchies.
And nothing on Earth is open.
In some places, unfortunately, yeah. There are a lot of things that I hate about the suburbs, but at least in the suburbs, if you need to get Cheetos at 12:30 in the morning, you don't have to go to the gas station. I think that was the place you had to go in Florida. Garden District if you needed anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's this other guy, he goes to a nearby star and then comes back. And so the one twin stays on Earth, the other one zips off and comes back to Earth in some long but relatively doable amount of time.
So 20 years, let's say.
Yeah. Let's say he does that in 20 years. He comes back, and since I haven't done the math, let's say for the twin that was on Earth, it's been 50 years, right?
Mm.
It's been a much longer period of time, but it's much more fun if he's still alive when the other one gets back so that you can do the face-to-face comparison.
Yeah.
Each one, right, has been, for most of that time, has been in an inertial reference frame. And so you're wondering, well, why would one get older and one not? Well, the reason is because one had to go to another spot and then turn around and come back. And so there's a longer spatial distance between those two points. So that's going to make it a shorter amount of time in the meantime, which seems a little weird, right? It seems a lot weird when you think about that. But when you look at exactly how the mathematics works in relativity, so that you have the speed of light as a universal constant, that's actually what has to happen is the shorter your distance between two events, the longer it takes to get there, which again is just a very strange thing.
I always think of it as like a trade-off, like the more space you move through, the less time you're moving through. I mean, from your initial starting point, right?
Yeah, and it only ever means anything if you're coming back to the same point. But yeah, I mean, that's really what it is. It is a trade-off because of the way that distances are measured in special relativity.
I just wanted to say what I love about this, and we know for a fact that this is real from, you know, all kinds of different experiments, including particle accelerators where particles would decay and we can see how the time dilation extends, how much time they survive before they decay, is that this is a proven thing. So if you want to travel into the future, you just need to move close to the speed of light and you are there, man.
Yeah, you just need a long round trip. It's always so weird when you figure out what can actually be done that way. And then it's very sad that even though it's conceptually very easy to do some of these things, how much energy it would take, it makes it practically impossible.
Yeah.
I don't remember the exact amount of time, but you can circumnavigate the universe within your lifetime. And it might be a reasonable fraction of your lifetime, too.
That's a 1G. If 1G constant acceleration. Yeah.
Yeah. You just have to figure out how to do that constantly.
Yeah, we have no way to do that. Not even remotely close.
It's just a very strange effect.
But I love that anecdote because most people think that it's impossible to ever see the universe or that, you know, because of the huge distances and everything. It's like, no, actually, special relativity tells you that the universe is your oyster. If you can somehow figure out a way to accelerate to those velocities, time dilation helps you. And distance becomes less and less relevant. If you've got a constant acceleration somehow, and that's the real trick, of course, is how do you do that? But if you can accelerate constantly, distances get kind of compressed. So if you're traveling for twice as long, then the amount of distance that you can cover is, you know, exponentially greater. So it's, in a way, space gets closer and closer to you as you accelerate, you know? So it kind of brings everything within your realm. That's exciting to think that you could live to see the farthest reaches of the observable universe if you could travel fast enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing thing. And it's I didn't realize people didn't realize it.
Yeah, even today, people are like, oh, you know, there can't be UFOs in the sky because it takes so long to get here because the distances are so vast and everything. It's like, no, actually, if some craft can accelerate it 1 or 2 G's, they can get anywhere they want to go in the universe within their own lifetime. It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you don't want to go back.
That's right.
So that's a trade-off there.
I say, bring your friends and family with you and you're good.
The most realistic science fiction that you'll ever read are the alien invasion ones. Because once they decide to come here, you know, they don't have any other choice.
Oh, they're stuck. That's right.
That's right.
We can't go back. There's nobody there. Our planet died billions of years ago. But it was last week from us traveling.
That's right.
So you can go see amazing distances and come back. And hey, you're way in the future now. And maybe they figured out closed time-like curves by that point.
Closed time-like curves? Was that for a transition?
No. I just brought that up. We're going to get into that. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about general relativity because that's another way that we know that you could travel into the future.
Yeah, I mean, we need to talk about general relativity at least a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about gravitational time dilation.
Okay, what do you know about that?
Well, on the Earth, it's very small. One of the interesting things about general relativity that kind of shocked me was that the time dilation of the gravitational field is the same as you would experience at escape velocity. So if you are moving at the escape velocity to escape from the Earth's gravity field, and then you can use the special relativity equation to figure out what your time dilation is, and you can apply that to what the actual time dilation is gravitationally on the Earth. So it's a really small fraction, like we're aging very, very slightly less fast than a point far away from the Earth's gravitational field, but it is real. You can even detect it with a laser on the surface of the Earth.
And so if you go to some place that's much, much more massive, then you should stay around a lot longer, and except, you know, in your own perception.
Yeah, like if you could hang out near some like neutron star or something without getting shredded by tidal forces or whatever, then that gravitational field would be like a time machine for you. Or think of it this way, if we could build some kind of machine which would create a uniform gravitational potential inside of a sphere or something, then you could go in there, turn up the field, and it would be like a high-speed train moving you into the future.
Was it in that video I sent you, and I forgot who it was who was talking, where somebody was...
James Gleick.
Yeah, where he was asking people whether they wanted to see the future in the past, and half of the people said they wanted to go see the future. And if you were one of those people, the opportunity is there.
Yeah, right. The universe is your oyster. The physical laws are just waiting for you to exploit them.
That's right. You just need to figure out how to get to the right place and hang out there for a week. In fact, I think I'll build a resort there for you. It won't be too pricey.
Travel through time and style. I love it. Free cocktails.
Oh, God, no. No. Yeah, the whole point in putting a place there is that it would be a great, big, huge, time-dilated tourist trap.
You keep them there too long, you're going to end up, you know, with an extinguished sun when you get out.
Yeah, actually, I don't know how that would work. Probably the best thing, I guess this is getting into absurdities, but if you were to build something like that, the best thing would be to make everything free when they get there and to collect the money up front on Earth. You know, unless you've actually made the trip. Then you don't know if it would do you any good to have any money when you came back.
That's a good point. When you turn off the field, you might just, you know, walk out into an irradiated hellscape.
Either that, or it'll turn into a Star Trek economy where
the money's...
There's no money. There's nothing interesting. You can get anything you want from whatever those food processing dinghies are. You've got holodecks, and now you've got every fantasy you ever wanted. I mean, I don't know how they get anything done.
Yeah, exactly. There was a funny episode in The Next Generation where some guy got addicted to the holodeck, and they never really talked about it, but, you know, he was probably getting busy.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, I mean, the same thing happens with general relativity. I mean, and you should expect that, because one of the big points about general relativity is if you're accelerating, it's just like being in a gravitational field. If you can't tell the difference between acceleration and gravitation, then you get stuck with the same ideas with the acceleration.
Except there's that weird thing where in special relativity, the two observers moving relative to each other, they disagree about whose clock is moving more slowly, because they both think that the other guy's clock is moving more slowly. But with general relativity in gravitational time dilation, both observers agree that the one within the field is moving more slowly than the one outside the field.
That's only going to be true if in special relativity both observers are in inertial reference frames. Isn't that the case?
That's right. Because whenever you add accelerations to it, then you know who got into the other Lorentz transformed space-time, and then you can actually see who got older and who didn't. All right, so the next thing that I wanted to talk about on this is more hypothetical, is that there's another direction that's theoretically possible for gravitational time dilation, and that's if there is a form of like a negative gravitational field or an anti-gravitational field. Now, that's still speculative, but if dark energy is actually what we kind of model it now as, it's sort of an anti-gravitational thing. And it's spread out through the universe now, so you can't concentrate it, and we don't know if that's even going to be possible. But in the farthest reaches of theoretical physics, it is, and within general relativity, it is permitted that you could bend space-time the other way. And if you got inside of an anti-gravity field that was really intense, then time dilation would work the opposite way, and time would appear to move faster on your clock than it would for somebody who's outside the field. So that's like the other, you know, speculative direction of time dilation within general relativity, is that it can work in either way.
Okay, and in that case, that means people could basically, oh, that would be horrible. I mean, that would be like that Black Mirror episode with the prison.
Yes.
And you just toss the guy into that little place for 40 years and he'd come out in 2 weeks.
Yes.
In your time. Oh, that would be terrible. That would be a horrible thing to do.
Although there was a great Wild Wild West episode back in the day where I think it was Dr. Loveless. Dr. Loveless had figured out some kind of potion that he could drink to make him move really fast through time. And there was a Star Trek episode that was kind of like this too, where the people moving really fast through time could do like amazing stuff that the other people couldn't do, you know, because they could come and go and take your drink and, you know, rob you blind and exit through the back door without you even knowing what happened.
But that would be very difficult to do with, you know, a negative gravitational field, because, you know, whatever was doing that to you would happen to all the people around you. And that ruins all the fun.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. How are you going to pickpocket somebody if they're inside the field and they're like, hey, what the hell are you doing?
Do you remember how they modeled the dark matter? Do they just model that as a negative cosmological constant?
I was reading about this on Sean Carroll's page, and he does a nice treatment of it. He was saying that if there's a positive energy density to empty space, and there's no matter inside of it, that the positive energy density actually... How does this work? That it actually creates a negative pressure, and the negative pressure is like the opposite of stress, the kind of space-time stress that matter usually puts in on space-time. And so, yeah, it's a positive energy that creates a negative pressure field, and in general relativity, negative pressure in space-time, if it's uniform everywhere, and the energy can't expand out anywhere without creating more space-time, which is, and then it stays uniform even as it expands, then you get this crazy effect. It's like an anti-gravity effect, and it pushes matter apart, and they look at it as the cosmological constant in, it's like the quantum field sort of idea, trying to connect that with Einstein's cosmological constant, which he just threw in as an ad hoc way to prevent the universe from collapsing in on itself from gravity. And I think it, I don't know if this is true, but apparently he thought that was a mistake, or he thought that it was rather ad hoc later on. And then in 1998, we realized, holy, it's there.
Yeah, they've since decided that it is there, but Einstein apparently had second thoughts about it. I've heard that more than once, so I assume it's correct.
Right, because when he came up with the general theory of relativity, they didn't know about the Big Bang. So they had no idea that the universe has started out really small and blown up into its current size. So he didn't understand why it wasn't recollapsing in on itself. The thing is that we don't really have a good model for it yet. I mean, the explanations that we have to describe the cosmological constant seem really hand-wavy, and nobody's detected any kind of a particle that would seem like a dark energy particle, so we just don't know what to make of it yet. We just know that it seems to be real. And that's the other thing that I wanted to mention, is that right now is a really hot and exciting field of research in astronomy, because they are looking at what's called the full nonlinear late-time integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which is also known as the Riesz-Skyama effect. And I think it's Martin Riesz and Dennis Skyama, the discoverers of dark energy. And what they're hoping to detect is the photons from the cosmic microwave background radiation, they get pulled into the gravitational wells of galaxy clusters. And then, because the universe is expanding, apparently those kind of get flattened out a little bit as time passes. Maybe it's also because the galaxies are losing a little bit of mass as they radiate photons into space. That gives them a little bit of a shift, a little kick of energy. But then there's also these hills, and the hills would be the dark energy regions that are sort of in between the massive, like the galaxy clusters over long distances. And it's super subtle. It's a very slight hill, but they think they're going to be able to detect it by studying the cosmic microwave background radiation. And they're also looking for evidence of this positive space-time curvature from dark energy in the cosmic evolution that they observe, like how clustered the galaxies are and that kind of jazz. So we may be able to detect the effect of dark energy warping space-time in the opposite direction of gravity just in the next few years, because they're looking at it right now. So when we look at general relativity especially, what I wanted to point out is that it seems pretty reasonable to expect that theory would allow us to move with gravity faster into the future or more slowly into the future. But with all the stuff that we sort of feel confident about now, that's sort of the limit. You know, that seems like the most confident we can be, is that we should be able to change the rate at which we move into the future. But moving backwards is where it gets really hairy.
Yeah, so the idea here is we were talking about space and time being sort of intermingled, so that the time direction doesn't really always point in the same direction for every individual particle in the universe. Depending on how fast they're going, that sort of direction of time is a little bit different. So, you know, what would be the axis, the time axis on a graph, if they were to sort of plot things? That's at a slightly different angle. Those are all at different angles between observers.
But they all seem to be positive ultimately, right?
Yeah, they all seem to be positive. But, I mean, the kind of strange thing about that is that some of the space gets mixed up with the time gets mixed up with the space, but not too much space gets in your time, and not too much time gets in your space, but just enough to do all this sort of stuff. But in the end, there's a big difference between space and time. And the big difference is that, you know, there's no limit to how far to the left you can go or how far to the right you can go. You can go in either direction right now, or you can take 3 steps forwards, or you can take 2 steps back. That's all up to you. But in the time direction, there seems to be some reason why we keep on going forward, and we just sort of have to postulate that's something that happens, just because it's something that seems to happen, and it seems to happen to everything, and there are good reasons to think that it does. We're stuck going forward in time all the time. For all these space-like areas, right, where, you know, two events can't affect each other. You know, you can sort of move-ish in that direction, although you can't get to an event there. For any place where there are two events that can affect each other, there are events that can affect you right now and events that you can affect, let's say. But all of the ones that you can't affect are in sort of one region behind you in time. And all the ones that you can affect are in one region ahead of you. And hopefully I didn't say the same thing twice. And so we just need to come to some idea about what that really means. Is that something that has to be? If that's not something that has to be, in what ways are they not that? How could you be your own grandpa, right? Actually, there's a song about that. It's perfectly possible. But we'd like to see if there's a way to go backwards in time so that we could go to a spot that would be causally related to what we're doing right now. Go to a spot that could be causally related to where we are right now. That is, if we just let things evolve normally, can we end up with a coffee cup that we'd made in the future or something like that?
Well, I think that so far it seems like only really exotic and special fringe. I mean, we're kind of jumping off of the horizon of physics frontiers into the abyss with this stuff, because we're pushing general relativity to the ripping point, perhaps. But one of the things that that really, I think, struck Einstein squarely between the eyes is when his friend Kurt Gödel in 1949 published his paper, An Example of a New Type of Cosmological Solutions of Einstein's Field Equations of Gravitation. And clearly the man was, you know, not a curt or succinct speaker. But he describes in that paper a solution to Einstein's general relativity for a rotating universe. And that has some really weird properties.
I think just because of this paper, we're not really pushing things too far. I think a lot of people are trying to find ways to say that some of the things that are possible in this solution to Einstein's equations are not viable spacetimes, right? Or at least not things that we could ever see. I mean, that's a separate thing. I think these show that this is not a completely crazy thing, right? The way you've constrained this podcast, right, where you wanted to talk about these closed time-like curves, these are something that are perfectly possible. As far as general relativity itself is concerned, these are completely possible solutions to the field equations. And I think that's a reasonable thing to look at in any event. I don't think these do exactly what we want them to do, or exactly what some of the other authors that we might talk about later were talking about, because at least one claim by Gödel was that you wouldn't have closed time-like curves here. He said you'd have closed null geodesics so that a particle of light could close in on itself. But his claim was that none of the mass particles could do that.
I thought that matter particles could do it if their universe was spinning fast enough.
Well, his claim in here is that every world line of matter occurring in the solution is an open line of infinite length, so that you're not getting any of these sort of closed loops in space-time that people are going to talk about as far as some of these paradoxes that they come up with. Something like the coffee cup, where I go back in time, give myself a coffee cup from the future, and then that's the coffee cup that I take back and give to myself again and again and again.
I must have misunderstood that, because I thought that he was saying that there were closed time-like curves that you could traverse sort of in like a big circular orbit and come backward in time, but that you wouldn't arrive at the same position in space somehow.
That would be perfectly fine with this interpretation here. But then it wouldn't be a closed time-like curve.
Oh, I thought that it was closed in time, but not in space.
My understanding of it is a closed time-like curve is going to mean that you're always going forward in time, locally, but by that you can go to a spot that you would have thought was the past earlier.
I think he was saying that, is that you could go back to an earlier time, so it was closed in time, but I guess because of the universe's rotation, you'd end up in a different position in space.
Well, I think that is sort of what he's trying to say, so that, you know, you could go back and meet yourself, but you couldn't come back and be yourself.
Ah, right, yeah. You wouldn't be able to occupy the same space at the same time.
And, of course, you have to look at some of the things he's talking about as far as how fast you're actually going to have to go, in the real world at least, to satisfy these things.
So he's talking about near light speed velocities at this crazy looping trajectory, is that right?
You also have to figure out what it is for the particular person or the particular point that's doing it.
Yeah, because I was reading another article and they said that, so it's possible that, I think I read somewhere that it's possible that the universe is rotating and that we're in a Gödel space-time. but that we haven't been able to detect it yet. And that's what's totally messing with my mind, is I read an article in the Science Times and the New York Times 10 or 15 years ago now, and it was an unassuming article, but it was absolutely had caught my fascination, and it said that the astronomers had detected that there was a rotation to the universe by observing the polarization of light, and I've never heard anything else about it ever since. Maybe it was disproven, maybe it was a mistake, but the implications would be enormous because we would be in a girdle universe if that was true. I remember them even telling what axis that the rotation was happening on. Like, they even said which constellations you could draw a line between, and the rotation was is along that axis.
Well, I mean, those things could happen, but I think this is also a fairly rigid rotation. It's actually a very strange thing, the way it's put together. It's not as strange as you might think, but it's still a fairly strange idea that the universe is relatively homogeneous and everything's rotating at the same rate.
Yeah, because the space-time is rotating, and then you don't feel any centripetal acceleration because it's the space-time rotating, not the matter. Or I mean, I guess the matter within it is moving with it, but there's no differential, right? So that's crazy. Like, that's just really, it's amazing that this guy in 1949 had that thought.
When people asked him about it, he thought it was just something that was obvious. When he did this, he didn't, as I recall, because like I said, at one point I had a popular book on this subject and somebody was talking about it. When Gödel had this idea, he was surprised nobody published it because to him it was so obvious.
I'm just thinking, if I was Einstein and I heard that idea, I would have let out a loud gasp. I would have been like... My God, you're right. To have found that solution, it's a stroke of creative genius.
You do know who Kurt Gödel is, right?
Well, I know he was a genius mathematician and philosopher, but I don't really know much more about him than that.
Oh, he was the mathematician who proved that mathematics doesn't work.
Oh, I remember that now. I remember reading about that a little bit, yeah. Something about he like proved that math couldn't describe reality or something like that.
The idea here is not that math couldn't describe reality. The idea is that mathematics is essentially incomplete, so that you can't get a set of axioms that will encompass all the mathematics that you want to cover. So this was sort of the project prior to Gödel's incompleteness theorems, which was, how can we get together a set of axioms that, with a few definitions here and there, we can put together all of mathematics from a few simple rules. And Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead, they actually put together something called the Principia of Mathematica, which was this huge, I think, 3-volume set where they were just trying to prove all of set theory and logic and number theory just through a few simple axioms. And it was an amazing tour de force that the incompleteness theorem said, well, it's not going to work for everything. I can find something that's basically the Cretan paradox, the liar paradox. I can find a way to make the liar's paradox out of any mathematics you give me. So it's not going to say anything's right or anything's wrong. It's going to say there is a statement or a theorem or something that will not be provable from the basic ideas that you bring to the table. And so he was the person who figured out how to do that. He had a very creative mind, and this was just a second sort of thing that he did, and really reinforced that when I found he'd done it. This is sort of the level of creativity these really, really smart guys have.
Yeah, I think I'd seen the title, Incompleteness Theorem, and I hadn't followed up on it, but I'm glad you did, because I didn't realize that it was that fundamental.
Yeah, I mean, it just really destroyed the way mathematicians were proceeding, the way mathematicians thought about their own discipline when he figured this out. Yeah, it's just one of the really great things that somebody's been able to figure out. But yeah, I mean, this is just something that he thought up while he was sitting on his porch or something.
He was having the morning coffee and he's like, oh yeah, all this mathematics, I can tear it all to shreds.
Not the incompleteness theorems. Those were work. I mean, these field equations, this was something he did on vacation.
Oh, you mean the whole rotating universe solution to general relativity? He just kind of...
Yeah. Yeah, he was just sitting by the seaside, sipping on a drink. This is what came out.
He's like, hey, by the way, you guys know that, you know, in a rotating universe, it's closed time like curves, right?
Yeah, I have no idea how this exactly happened. But I think, well, like I said, to him, this was obvious. And I think for him, even the calculations and stuff were fairly simple. I mean, the way he did it, he said, okay, you know, I figured out how to set this up so that only 2 of these 40 derivatives being non-zero. And then all of a sudden, all these nasty things that you look at when you learn about general relativity aren't so nasty when you only have have two instead of however many you normally have, which is much less than 40, but is still a bear.
I remember reading that there's huge implications for this theory, too, because according to the Gödel metric, every point in space-time is connected to itself through this time-like curve loop, and that means that our ideas about past and future become irrelevant, almost like relative. According to his metric, the only thing that's absolute is the present, and there's no more absolute time in the universe.
That would be an implication in some way. You still would have with this the forward directedness of time. So you still have this arrow of time. But if you're in a universe where something like this is a solution, where you can have these closed time-like curves, now you don't have an absolute future and an absolute past.
Exactly.
And that seems totally reasonable.
Super cool, though.
Okay. So did we have any comments about these closed time-like curves?
Well, I think we should mention that in an expanding universe, it looks like it's very difficult for the Gödel metric to survive with closed time-like curves. It seems like when they try to resolve his model with what we know about the universe now, that it seems increasingly unlikely that every point in space-time is connected to itself through a closed time-like curve that's subliminal.
That might be true, but I think the problem is if we're going to add things like dark energy, these things might actually be true.
Oh, they might balance out.
The thing is that Gödel's metric is for a cosmological constant that's non-zero. So once you sort of allow that, then you have this issue. Now, I don't know if it's got this negative energy, according to these other things that you sent me, to actually make these things happen, to have these closed time-like curves, you need a negative energy. You should have a negative energy density in a large enough region for a large enough time so that you can have these closed curves. On top of that, to do anything interesting with, like to go back and meet your own grandpa, you have to have them in a fairly constrained area. So that makes it even more difficult. That's where you start talking about Kip Thorne and wormholes and stuff like that. Getting these things in a constrained area so that they loop around and do something practical is another issue. And of course, some other people were talking about here that you couldn't go back into your past unless you'd already built one of these machines in the past and constantly maintained it for the entire time. And that makes it a whole lot less fun.
It is less fun that way, but it also is kind of logically satisfying, because the thought that you couldn't go back any earlier than you built the time machine would kind of explain why there's no time travelers hanging out.
Yeah, that, and even trying to get something with that sort of energy density so that you could curl space-time back in on itself in some way. Everything says about these closed time-like curves that are these kinds of solutions that it's probably not very likely that you're going to do that anywhere where you'd actually want to be. You're probably not going to use some trick with these in a terrestrial experiment, and you're probably not even going to do it somewhere in the solar system. You might have to set up a special galaxy.
We're just going to set this galaxy aside for our time machine.
Everything that I'm looking at here sort of points in that direction.
Yeah.
For this to be a subset of the normal space, you need it to be a very large subset, if it can even work as a subset. I think a couple of these theories that aren't Gödel's look at subsets and the way they can do that, although some of them are even less forthcoming about how they do that. They remove these spheres from a patchwork of Minkowski space-time, and then you take these spheres and connect them all back together. Now you have something that looks locally like a Minkowski space-time, but it's really only locally Minkowski, and it can make this time travel loop, but there's no explanation in that and how you did that.
Right. Yeah, this is not a technique. They're just probing the outer limits of theoretical physics to see if they can make it do it.
And that's even worse. You know, now I don't even have any idea about what's going on. I guess that's okay in some region because you're just looking at, can I make this work? But after you say, yes, I can make this work, now I want to know, well, how can you make it work?
Well, I did see a little bit of discussion in one of these papers. I think it was Wormholes, Time Machines, and the Weak Energy Condition. It was a little letter that Kip Thorne and some people wrote in 1998 where they talked about very briefly that if you had a sphere that was the diameter of the Earth's orbit around the sun, and that if you could contain if you could engineer this sphere to have another sphere that was right up next to it within, like, I don't know, nanometers, so that you'd be exploiting the Casimir effect to have a negative energy density in that region. And if there was some pressures, I guess there was some kind of pressure involved that was equivalent to the center of a star, then, you know, you might be able to generate this kind of effect. But you're basically talking about trying to work with matter sort of like a black hole. You know, like you're warping space-time so much that it's basically like a black hole, and you're curving space-time around into a loop. And somehow it's got two ends to it. I'm not really sure how they have two ends to the wormhole, but this is Kip Thorne's work created kind of a wave of excitement about time travel in the 80s and 90s. And this is where I wanted to see if I could get your thoughts on this, because so your wormhole is basically a spherical shape, and there's some kind of layer where it's like I guess the warping layer, but somehow you hold it open with a whole bunch of negative energy, and then there's a path that you can travel through the center safely, and then you come out at the other end, and it's also like a spherical shape, and you can appear in another point in space. So he says that if you take one end of the wormhole and you accelerate at relativistic speeds so that it gets time dilated, or maybe if you put it near a black hole so that it gets time dilated and hold it there for a while, and then you bring it back next to the other opening of the wormhole, then you could move in one hole and come out the other end, and we would have traveled backwards in time. I'm having a hard time understanding that, because when you look at it procedurally, let's say you've got the two openings to the wormhole side by side, you take one opening, and you move it to the relativistic speeds, and then bring it back to where you started, and then you go in one end. How are you going to come out the other end further in the past? Because if you go back in time, then it wouldn't have been accelerated relativistically yet. Aren't you just making the other end of the wormhole younger? Hasn't it just aged less? And wouldn't you come out at the same time anyway? I'm confused about how you maintain that space-time geometry where you can move into the past. It doesn't seem to really make sense to me.
All right, well, I guess it's too late to start over. Well, I'm sorry, everyone. My recording stopped at about 103 minutes into the recording, which will be a lot earlier for this. We were talking about all sorts of wonderful stuff. I'm sure you'd love to hear about all of these things, but they just weren't recorded. I'm really sorry, but it's just too late at night for me to start over and continue on and all that other fun stuff. So, Randy, do you have anything else that you'd like to say at this point?
I'd like to mention the Tipler cylinder if people want to do a little reading on one hypothetical time travel device. It's kind of an interesting example. And we'll talk about time on some other shows in the future.
Yeah, so we want to talk about time on some other shows, and we had problems with understanding those wormhole things. We'll put those on the list and try to figure out what's going on with those. All right. Well, thanks for talking to me about this, Randy.
Hey, my pleasure, and thank you for talking with me about this. I really enjoy hearing your thoughts on all this.
Sounds great. Bye now, Randy.
Bye, Jim. There's the Novikov self-consistency principle, which basically says that if you travel to the past, you can't change anything, because you can't create paradoxes, and that seems kind of arbitrary and silly. And then there's the many worlds interpretation, which says that you don't travel back into your own past, you travel back into the past of another universe, so you're not actually changing your own past. And then there's the Hawking chronology protection conjecture, which says that if you try to build a time machine, somebody will kill you, or it will blow up in your face, or whatever, but the universe won't let you travel back in time.